Welcome. My name is John Stone. I'm at the University of Illinois.
I'm Kyle Stedman from Rockford University. We're here today to talk about Thomas Rickert's Ambient Rhetoric, The Attunements of Rhetorical Being, a book that came out recently on University of Pittsburgh Press
in 2013.
When I think of a normal book review that I see in a journal that I hold in my hand in print, I expect it to kind of walk me through each of the chapters. I expect it to praise the really good stuff and make connections to other scholarship on the topic. And I think we're going to do some of that. We're trying to let people have a sense of what some of the important parts of this book are, but it's more than that too, right?
Exactly. I think what we're hoping to accomplish here is to attune listeners to the fact that this is a sonic experience, that you're listening to our voices rather than reading our words. And in fact, Kyle and I are both interested in sound and rhetoric. And so we're going to try to bring our particular interests to this book and talk really about the ways that Rickert and his book Ambient Rhetoric provide tools for us to do the work that we love to do. And I think that's kind of the conclusion. We're revealing the end in some way here, but the conclusion that we both came to, I think, is that the language, the approach, some of the theoretical concepts that Rickert comes to in Ambient Rhetoric really do lend themselves well to thinking through the ways that rhetoric is related to sound.
Right.
2013 was a big year for me and you, Kyle.
Absolutely.
We went to a concert together.
We did. And even though this is a book review in a sense, we want people to get a sense of some of the important stuff here. I actually am really hoping we'll talk about Pearl Jam.
last summer, Kyle and I had the opportunity to go see Pearl Jam at Wrigley Field, which was kind of awesome. And this amazing opportunity to see this iconic band from the 90s. We both grew up in the 90s.
Well, and it was awesome in a lot of ways, and when I tell the story, I always say, man, it was just so amazing. And yet, I think there were a lot of ways that it didn't feel awesome in the moment, right? We both had some trouble getting there. There was, oh, by the way, that massive storm that kept us there till 2 a.m.
Yeah. All the while being serenaded by this music that has meant so much to us, or used to mean so much to us as kids.
For sure.
And also being in this really iconic place on Wrigley Field. The stage was set up in center field, right underneath the green scoreboard that is so well known. Kyle and I kind of got onto the field and looked around, and there were thousands of people there, many in like Pearl Jam shirts from like 1992 when they saw them at Lollapalooza in Phoenix, Arizona.
Totally.
And then also kind of peppered by Cubs fans and yeah, baseball t-shirts and the workers at Wrigley, most of whom who were probably over 60 years old, all of us were there to experience this concert.
And they brought that place, the band brought that place very purposely into part of their performance after the very long, how long was it, 3 hours?
Well, there was a rain delay, which they had played for only like 8 songs. And all of a sudden this huge storm was supposed to come. It actually didn't come for an hour and a half after they promised it would be there. It was a rain delay. Very baseball.
Very baseball. And after that rain delay, they started the second, I want to say second half, but it was much the second two-thirds by introducing a song written at the request of Ernie Banks, a legendary Cubs player, written at his request about Wrigley Field, about the Cubs. And they sang it in that place. They invited Ernie Banks to stage. Ernie said, here is the baseball glove that Eddie Vedder bought here when he was 5 years old, when he was growing up in Evanston, Illinois, around the corner, and now he's taking it back. So it was interesting how all of these places were brought into the musical event, brought into the communication from the stage and the fans, and we couldn't forget it. It was clearly part of what was going on.
Right. And I've been to a lot of shows up in Chicago, living in Champaign, Illinois right now, and none are as memorable as this Pearl Jam show, mostly because the expectations that I had about the show actually weren't met. I went thinking I was going to have one experience and had a completely different one. And that difference has meant a lot to me related to the kind of the meaning of the show afterwards.
And meaning is a very, that's a word that gets us towards the book.
Yeah, and that's exactly what I was thinking about. We were thinking about, you know, an experience that we had both had together that lended itself well to thinking through some of the concepts of this book. And this Pearl Jam show really does that in a lot of ways because of the emphasis on the sounds that were happening there, the people, the relationships, the place. Both the place being Wrigley Field is kind of a place in Chicago that a lot of people gravitate towards who are baseball fans. But also, and Kyle mentioned this, Eddie Vedder's kind of deep embedded histories that he had, familial histories with Chicago, with the baseball stadium. And
he called the stadium the crown jewel of the planet at one point. And he's kind of building up, saying this is not only one of my favorite cities to play in, but this is the crown jewel of the planet itself.
All right, at the risk of making this too much about Pearl Jam and not enough about ambient rhetoric, what was rhetorical about this experience? There was something about this experience that lended itself well, as we were both reading ambient rhetoric, to thinking through some of the concepts that Rickert introduces there, concepts like ecology, attunement, embeddedness, and just this idea of ambience itself, because that night it seemed like that the concert that we were experiencing was way more than just the typical experience of going and listening to, you know, a band that you like play songs.
Right. And it clearly wasn't rhetorical in kind of the classical sense of it, unless we're saying what were the rhetorical strategies that the band used to help us create the meaning that they wanted us to. I mean, that doesn't quite fit here. It's more complicated than that. There's histories and material and emotions and all these things that were in this big, crazy, messy ecology that led it to mean the experience that it meant for us.
Right. If anything, the rhetoric kind of inhered around this idea of expectations. Like, there were certain expectations about what seeing Pearl Jam at Wrigley Field would be like. Something else was going on that was causing us to have and react in certain ways. And certainly it wasn't just us. We were there being with thousands of other people with similar expectations, but also ended having an experience that couldn't have been anything else, but was completely different from what we expected.
Right. And that experience wasn't designed by anyone, right? That was undesignable. It was a sense of, if we can turn to some of the book's language, I think it was a sense of the world disclosing itself to us. And by the world, I mean all of those things we were talking about. So even with that whole story, we haven't said anything yet about what this has to do with rhetoric itself. So let me turn to an interesting quote from really early in Rickert's book. This is from the preface or the introduction. There's an introduction and a preface. This is the introduction. He writes that rhetoric must diffuse outward to include the material environment. Things, including the technological, our own embodiment, and a complex understanding of ecological relationality as participating in rhetorical practices and their theorization. Help me unpack that a little bit. I think it's important.
There's a lot there, isn't there? But I think that this will also help to kind of structure our review, because these are the things that I think that we're the most interested in and excited about. I think what's most interesting in this particular definition is not necessarily the way that it's different from classical rhetoric, but the way that it builds upon it, the way that it encourages a broader understanding of what we mean when we talk about rhetoric. Rickert is really good throughout the book in bringing in all kinds of other things that are often overlooked in the typical, I guess it's Aristotelian approach to rhetoric, that rhetoric is the ability in any given situation to find the given ways of persuasion.
And kind of control that, right? And kind of to kind of chaotically assume a control over I don't know, what people experience, as if we could.
Right. So it's in other words, the rhetoric kind of has this almost godlike control over the environment, rather than the environment participating in, or the human rhetor being just one part of a complex group of associative things and people and places.
Yeah, well, and tell me if this is a stretch, but the way you're talking, that sounds very sonic. It sounds like the sounds that I make in any place at any time are always enmeshed in the other sounds around me, right?
Right.
So no matter how much we try to get rid of the material traces of everything we're involved with, we're still there. We're still enmeshed. We're still part of an ecology. And I think what we're seeing, the reason us two are interested so much in this is because ambient rhetoric is bigger than just sound, right? It's bigger than just music. It's more about the way that everything about a world discloses itself to us and changes us, partly through human action and partly through non-human, is action the right word? I don't know.
Sure.
But I think it also especially applies to sound. And I think that's why parts of this especially have gotten us really excited.
Exactly. And I'm even kind of having fun listening to us, although we're both kind of nervous, I think, trying to talk about these concepts out loud.
Seriously.
But we're working on it. You know, I think these are some new, there's some new vocabulary here that, that Rickard provides for not just scholars of sound, but he provides vocabulary concepts and kind of, it's an ambient theory, isn't it? For scholars of rhetoric who are pushing on the boundaries of some of these traditional ideas about what we generally and typically hold up as our theories of rhetoric.
Yeah, I don't think it's an accident that the couple of other reviews I've seen of this book are both non-traditional. I'm thinking of Trisha Campbell's review in Acculturation.
I'm going to offer an ambient I'm going to do something else. Remediation.
I'm going to offer
review.
And the interview Nathaniel Rivers had with Rickard in a couple of breweries in St. Louis in Cairo.
I am here with Thomas Rickard. I'm, of course, Nathaniel Rivers.
And I think there's something about these ideas that are attracting people who want to see rhetoric intensified. I mean, that's Rickard's word, right? He wants to see rhetoric intensified, not abandoned, or persuasion intensified, not abandoned. I'll make sure I say that right. So there's something that we it draws us to play, and it draws us to go beyond kind of this traditional word stuff. I think that's the thing that rhetoricians are really good at saying. Oh, you know, we want the multimodal, and we want all these interesting new ways of creating experiences for people. But I think we don't have a lot of that. So there's something here that's an invitation to that.
Bringing up the Nathaniel Rivers interview, it has me thinking about the conversation that they have at the very end. Remember that when Rickard talks about how music was a really important part throughout the whole book, and really, it's wonderful that the ways that he kind of sprinkles in music.
Absolutely, and there are even places where the insights of punk and of, you know, 70s rock and all these other things were put alongside philosophy. And Rickard a couple times kind of throws in a sentence defending that, saying, of course these people have insights into the way the world works, the way the world reveals itself to us, and the way we attune ourselves to that. I think that's the way he would put it. Of course, everyone has insight to that, including and maybe especially musicians.
It doesn't just stop there either. Rickard also, besides this kind of attentiveness to sound and the use of some sonic examples, which we'll get to in just a moment, he also uses this sonic language throughout, which I think is no accident. Even the word attunement itself is resonant and asks us to think about the ways things sound together or are tuned together. Another term that he uses frequently is the word key, as in the key of G, but he'll say the key of or an ambient key or a rhetorical key as a way of talking about not necessarily a singularity or a monotone, but the ways that that rhetoric itself is multitonal and chordal, and you know that it has these structures that work outside of just a singular linear space.
And I think even if you don't think of yourself as a musician, if you don't think of yourself as someone who has all the musical words, I think you know when the key changes in a song. I'm also thinking of a couple of other musical metaphors in chapter 2, which is about a new way to think about Kairos. At one point, Rickard writes, "I return to ancient Greek thought to restore a materialist tonality that has been waylaid in history." That's again thinking about the tonality is the whole musical language that goes into a piece. A certain major tonality will have a very different feel from a minor tonality or even some other kind of tonality that isn't Western. Later in that chapter, he even describes Kairos as a kind of harmony. So again, he's constantly, I think purposely, trying to remind us of the ways that this, again, is bigger than music, but includes music and maybe especially includes music.
Yeah, and not just music, I think, but I mean, there are several musical examples, but there's also just this idea of sound and sound space,
mm-hmm.
and place in particular. There's a fantastic example early on about the famous caves.
The cave paintings,
the
right?
Yeah, the cave paintings of, what is that cave again?
I want to say Lascaux. Is that how you say it in French? I don't know.
But just this new discovery that space wasn't just a place where there was visual art represented for the first time, but that space as a resonance space was just as important to understanding that particular the culture that produced it. Another one, and this is more contemporary, is early on he talks about the iconic drum sound on Led Zeppelin's "When the Levee Breaks," and the space that particular recording was made. This Headley Grange in East Hampshire, England, but the sound of the drums was achieved not just through the space, but by also like very careful microphone placement throughout the room that had created this sound.
Right, and that's a material affordance of the place, and it's not something that was designed in a classical rhetorical sense, right? Like yes, there's a sense in which where the mics were placed and how they decided to do it showed the rhetorical purposefulness of the subjects who were trying to create the sound they wanted, right? But it's also an example, and this is, I think, what Rickard wants to say, that it's an example of that space, in a sense, speaking for itself. It's disclosing itself. And not completely. There's still parts of it that we don't always understand and we can't control that withdraw from our understanding. But if we pay attention to what that space can say, what that space can add, what that space can mean to us, then I don't know, I guess he would say that's an example of us attuning ourselves to the ambience of a space and its potential.
Yeah, this discussion reminds me actually of a movie I just saw called Muscle Shoals, which is about it's about this recording studio in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, that has produced just hundreds of amazing records. You get people like Keith Richards from the Rolling Stones talking about just the specialness of the place.
Yeah.
How he would go there, and there was just something about the place. And they talk about the soil, and they talk about the river that passes through it. And not just like the great producer or the great, the room that they play in, or even this band that worked in this area, but literally that it had to do something about this place.
Yeah, and I really think that's a good intro to move into talking a little bit about chapter one and chapter two. Chapter one's about the kora, the Greek concept, and two about kairos. Let's talk a little bit about the kora first and the way that he wants us to revise it. And I actually have a quote here that I think might help us get going on that. On page 55, he says that ambience can never be understood simply as presence. Place is not simply an immediate environment. It includes the background by means of which things show up as what they are. What does that quote do for you?
I'm just keep on going back to Pearl Jam. You know, it's hard not to, because it just reminds me of not just Wrigley, not just the experience of listening to one of my favorite Pearl Jam songs, Release. When we first got there, it's still daylight outside. The music starts. All of a sudden, I'm transported back to the first time that I heard that song, it was like my first CD player at home.
Yeah.
And that, I know that other people are having that same experience of place and not just physical space, but place and time.
Well, and I think that's what Kora does for him. He doesn't want to just talk about place. He wants to talk about the ways that Ulmer, the ways that Kristeva have helped us see new ways of thinking about Kora. It draws attention to that stuff you're just talking about.
Yeah, this idea of Kora is interesting in that, it shines the spotlight on place, but it also demands of us to think really carefully about what place is and how it's meaningful.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so this reminds me of some work I've been doing recently in vernacular music. For example, the vernacular music that comes from the African-American tradition is oftentimes focused on activity. So you have work songs that help to keep the time of certain activities that were done, on a cotton plantation or something like that. Yeah. But they're also oftentimes embedded within those locations. They talk about things like the heat of the sun, the materiality of the cotton, the pain that of experiencing the work, all of those kind of ambient additions to just the song itself as an artifact.
A lot of captives are riding, God Almighty, not a Captain Rider.
What's really interesting about these is that they index not just the African Americans' experiences in the prisons or on Jim Crow plantations, but also, you know, as scholars like Amiri Baraka have noted, they index the experience of slave life itself and kind of go, I guess, so in other words, Cora, I think if we're to understand it correctly, we need to understand it both in terms of current place, but also place in time, if that makes sense.
Yeah, all the places that have built up to that moment. And you know, what I would even say that you're more of the expert on those folk songs than I am, but I do know that the Lomaxes traveled around and, you know, brought their giant recording equipment with them to right. record sometimes onto aluminum, right? And mm-hmm. so just the idea of how both the cultural situatedness of that idea of this white father and son team traveling around to African-American prisons, but also the materials they were bringing and the ways they were recording and how I would assume that anything you listen to now, you can hear echoes of that machinery that they use, those materials.
Yeah, absolutely. It's one of the really fascinating things about the sonic archive.
Sonic moments like that have that complex of a meaning. I think that's part of what Rickard is trying to draw our attention to with the whole notion of ambience, is that, hey, there are so many ambient things going on in any situation. It would be silly to assume that we can identify exactly the affordances of any single place, any single choric moment. And I think he really applies that to Kairos, too, in the next chapter, where he really has an issue with. Here's a quote from page 85. He doesn't like when contemporary theories of Kairos, quote, rely on an opportunistic frame, one that reinscribes it in a narrative of subjective control or advantage. And I think his issue with that that narrative of subjective control is that we assume that a moment comes to us and then we dive in and take advantage of it. When I think he would say that really Kairos needs to be understood almost. I don't know if this is too mysterious, but almost as if Kairos has its own sort of agency, as if the Kairos is something that is already there. And again, here's another quote that in some way the Kairos does what it does to us, with us and alongside us. It's on page 90. And there's something related there to what you're saying, that to understand this, we have to understand the ways that it was kairotic beyond anyone's control.
So wait, are you saying that a Rutter's decision is somehow willed by Kairos? Is it fate?
Well, Rickard really specifically says it's not. He even has this, no, I am not going for some new objective determinism, even though it sort of sounds like it here and there, right? But I think he would probably say, even though we're not controlled by Kairos, it's not fate. It's not that everything we say is predetermined. It's still more complicated than the idea of us reaching in and taking control.
Right. He uses these words on page 91. He says that it's a highly nuanced set of relations among language, environment, and people, and which I think is part of what's fun about it, is that it does seem to almost emerge as, you know, as serendipity in some ways, that there is this kind of interesting, Kairos has a serendipitous flavor sometimes.
But what that makes me think of is I was writing a blog post the other day about REM, and maybe that's a little related here. I was thinking about my personal history with REM, my personal history with the materialities, how the first two albums that I got on CD of REM were actually their first two albums, Murmur and Reckoning. But I had been an REM fan for years before I ever got those, and all the ones I'd had before that were on tape. So all of a sudden, I had these two. They were on a different medium. They sounded different. They were from different producers. They, you know, from the early '80s, and I was listening in the early '90s. There were all these things differently. And as I was writing this blog post, trying to tease this out, trying to figure out what my history was and what all this mattered, I turned to ambient rhetoric, and I was looking for an interesting quote that would help me understand this circumstance. And I found this one where Rickard says, ambience puts place, language, and body into co-adaptive, vital, and buoyant interaction. And in the serendipitous way, that word buoyant got me thinking. Started thinking about what it means to be buoyant, to be afloat in water. And then I started thinking about the second REM album, Reckoning, which I've learned through reading Wikipedia, I never noticed on my own, that a lot of the lyrics do talk about water. And on the spine of the record, it said File Underwater. Some people originally even thought that was the title of the album, File Underwater. In a very REM sort of way, that very kind of confusing Southern Gothic, purposely obscured underwater sort of meanings, in some ways connected to the things I was already thinking about in records. So I'm trying to decide, was that chirotic in the sense of me taking advantage of that moment? Was it choric in the sense of me stepping into the space of this blog and stepping into the space of this book and controlling it to say the things I wanted? It didn't feel that way to me. It felt more like I stepped into an interesting connection, and one that I love. That's my favorite part of that blog post, even though I don't even totally understand it.
So Kyle, your blog
reminded me
immediately of, you know, a dozen experiences that I've had that are similar.
Of course.
And you and I have had kind of serendipitous overlapping musical experiences beyond just Pearl Jam. But
yeah,
one of the things that he mentions actually on 108 that gets me thinking as well is back to the whole 90s alternative music scene.
Butch Vig.
Yeah, he talks about Butch Vig, Steve Albini, and their kind of... the ways that they're known as producers for producing a certain kind of sound on their records.
Kind of that Nirvana sound, the Smashing Pumpkins sound.
Yeah. Right, yeah. And, you know, Brian Eno is actually really well known for this as well, and kind of as being the fifth member of Coldplay over the last several years and producing, helping Coldplay kind of blend into the background of any given situation, right? Because you can hear Coldplay anywhere. It's interesting to me that, you know, whereas Butch Vig and Steve Albini are kind of more about bombast, you know.
Yeah.
Eno has been, and I think that Rickert writes about him in the book here, as being kind of a master of background music.
And background music on purpose, right? I listened to a lot of classical music. I was a music major for a while in undergrad before it turned into a minor. And it was a very classically oriented program. And I still listen to most classical music in the background, stuff I'm not paying attention to. And yet I sometimes kind of imagine these composers kind of like looking over my shoulder saying like, hey, I didn't write this for you to have it on in the background. I wanted you to pay attention and know what the moves I was doing meant. And here's Brian Eno, the way that Rickert describes it, really fascinatingly, making music on purpose for you to listen to in the background.
Right, or as a part of kind of a environmental experience. I mean, of course, there's this whole chapter on the Microsoft boot up sound, which is fascinating because we've all heard it.
Yeah, the way Eno writes it out is boom, bling, tink, tink, tink.
That's right.
We should almost do it in harmony. It's a boom, bling, tink, tink, tink.
Yeah, that's right.
And I'm sure we can insert the Microsoft sounds whenever we want, like here. You know, because of the magic of recording.
That's true.
Eno wants to set up an environment where you're surprised by the connections between the sound he makes and what that means to you and your environment. And he even wants to be surprised by that too. I love this idea that Rickert says Eno is simultaneously composer and audience. He's actant and recipient all at the same time.
Yeah, and he invites us to participate along with that as well. What does this have to do with ambient rhetoric?
Well, I think this fits into everything we've been saying earlier about decentering the human agent. Attuning ourselves, and I'm using the word attune pretty purposely, it's a Rickert word, attuning ourselves to the ways that all of the ambient features of an environment, the affect, the material, the emotional, the cultural, the historical, all of that are all part of what governs what can be communicated, said, experienced in that moment. And I think ambient music in the Brian Eno tradition, it kind of draws attention to that. It says, hey, there's more to this experience right now than just what I'm sending you. you have to pay attention to the rest, because I'm purposely asking you to pay attention to the rest.
Yeah, and I agree there, although I was going to play devil's advocate and ask, you know, in these particular cases, well, aren't they all still composed, right? Mm. Doesn't Butch Vig and Steve Albini and Brian Eno all have a very specific way of going about producing the kinds of, you know, of sounds that they're interested in very controlled environments, you know? And then I was reminded, I don't know if this completely answers the question, but a couple of years ago, right when iPhones kind of hit the market, or maybe a couple of years after, Eno produced an iPhone app called Bloom. I'm just reading from Wikipedia here. The software plays a low drone, and touching the screen produces different tones, which play in a loop.
Yeah.
If the screen is left untouched, the software will create its own music. Just this really interesting, user-generated music that relies on kind of a framework that Eno built, but he leaves it in the hands of the user to actually produce the sound.
And isn't that the nature of any kind of so-called interactive experience? You know, I'm thinking of Second Life or something. There's so much opportunity for me to step in there and in an interactive way make new things in the way that I want. But it's still within the parameters of the creator. And part of me wonders if Rickert would say that is what any rhetorical situation is like, that we're always within parameters. We're always within the parameters of the choric, chirotic situation that has been given to us, sometimes even more than we think we are. Let me also add that one reason the Eno stuff was so intriguing for my work was because I'm really interested in the historical ways people have understood music and rhetoric. And I find that when you look at kind of this European history, you know, going back to the 15, 1600s of people applying what they knew about rhetoric then to musical composition, I feel like the results always feel unsatisfactory to me as a rhetorical scholar. There's always kind of this overly simplistic application of a rhetorical term to music, and it always seems like, now I use this figure of rhetoric, so therefore it was rhetoric, and therefore that's what rhetoric is. It's just applying figures and understanding the figures. Ha ha, we're done. And so I've been in search for a while now of what, how do I put into words, you know this, what the complex contemporary ways we understand rhetoric, right?
Sure.
So I think that when I read Rickert, especially in these chapters 3 and 4, where he starts bringing up Eno, I start thinking, this is it. There's something here about reminding us that persuasion is still part of rhetoric, but it's bigger. It's intensified, like we mentioned earlier. Rickert says we have to include more than just what these old theories thought, and that helps me a lot. It's really really intriguing.
I'm going to take us on another tangent. So one of the concepts that I think is really interesting about that Rickert brings up over and over again is this reliance that traditional rhetoric has had on this notion of symbolicity. Mm-hmm. I was just thinking about, again, that's this idea of these producers, Steve Albini and Butch Vig, and the ways that their job is to produce kind of almost like a symbolic reflection of what the band sounds like. You get this idea of what, for example, the Smashing Pumpkins sound like live.
Yeah.
Billy Corgan's voice is banshee-like. There's a certain affect that you get, you know, kind of get accustomed to seeing them live. That almost completely disappears, especially on the kind of famous Butch Vig production, Siamese Dream, where you get this very clean, very melodic. Siamese Dream is kind of known for its overproduction.
Yeah, I remember being on Smashing Pumpkins' listserv in the mid-90s, and one of the questions going around was, what color do you associate with each album? You know, because that's what we talked about. And I remember the prevailing answer with Siamese Dream was silver. It was metallic. It's been overproduced to that level of perfection.
Right.
And by the way, it's my favorite album of ever.
Wow. It's up there for me too. Really, it really is. That disparity between the production quality, you know, album, and then and then seen them live. Even like they've been putting out, you know, these albums again. And one of the things that they often will come with are these, like, you know, extensive alternative takes and that kind of thing. And what you start to realize is that a certain song, say Today by Smashing Pumpkins, to take a well-known example, has achieved a certain iconic symbolic status in our minds that even slight differences in, you know, that experience are jarring, right?
Yeah.
And there's something, I think that there's something interesting there related to the ways that symbolicity as rhetoric kind of ends up maybe blocking or hiding some of what's actually present, what's kind of behind the production curtain.
What this is reminding me of when you're talking about the meaning beyond the symbolicity is it's making me think about some of Rickert's reliance on Heidegger and this idea that the interesting quote from Rickert, riffing off of Heidegger, is that we do not add meaning downstream. Our experience is one where something is always already interpreted as something. I'm still quoting here. In other words, what we do is always in the form of historically enculturated practices, most of which remain tacit or ambient in our everyday doings. That's on page 172. So I'm thinking about that Smashing Pumpkins sound, whether it's live or whether it's listening to Siamese Dream, and how my reaction to it, or the way it changes me, or the way it moves me in some way, whether it's emotional, but it's more than emotional, right? That is something that hits me in a moment. It all comes to me, and I don't stop and think, oh, that's an interesting sound there. I wonder how they got that drum sound, or I wonder how they did the guitar. Is that five guitars overlaid of each other, or is that 15 at that moment? And sure, I can stop and think that, but the immediacy of it comes before that. There's something that's straight ahead and right away, and that's something we've talked a little bit about before, trying to wrap our heads around how that concept of the totality of meaning, that Heideggerian, the message hits us. It's ontologically present in the world, but also we make sense of it phenomenologically, and what that has to do with ambient rhetoric.
And speaking of this kind of Heideggerian approach, one of the things we haven't talked a lot about here is the ways that the ideas that we're talking about are all related to, and I don't know if these are Rickert's words or if they're Heidegger's words, it's kind of a combination. It's hard to tell the difference sometimes of an ecological understanding of human flourishing.
Nice.
This just move towards understanding us as not just being, but being together, which I think is being with, being in the world. On page 15, Rickert gets into this. I'm just going to read at the bottom here. He says that the later Heidegger engages things and technology so as to suggest a profoundly ecological understanding of human flourishing. And this is the part I think is really interesting. One that tethers building, doing, and sociality to a dynamic sense of in-place attunement. This reimagines human agency less as a form of potent mastery than as caretaking, shepherding, sparing, or cultivation. This idea of caretaking and shepherding and cultivation seems useful as we start to think about, well, we've already been talking about it. We've been talking about these producers who, you know, put so much work and care into their own work. But also, I think it's reflective of the kinds of things that I think about as being useful in my own work. You know, how do I make the rhetoric of my work powerful? Well, I really have to care. You know, there has to be this care that goes into the stuff that I'm working on. But also with my students, I take this approach as well.
It also reminds me of Brian Eno, who once described his composing as a kind of gardening.
A gardener doesn't really work like that.
A sense of cultivating something, caring for it, getting down and thinking about what it means and what it means to you and what it can mean to other people. It starts to sound really...
An architect, at least in the traditional sense, is somebody who has an in-detail concept of the final result in their head. And their task is to control the rest of nature sufficiently to get that built. Nature being things like bricks and sites and builders and so on. Everything outside has to be subject to an effort of control. A gardener doesn't really work like that. But What I think about, I suppose my feeling about gardening, I suppose most people's feeling about gardening now, is that what one is doing is working in collaboration with the complex and unpredictable processes of nature. One is carefully constructing seeds or finding seeds, carefully planting them, and then letting them have their life. So, and that life isn't necessarily exactly what you'd envisage for them.
It starts to sound really important to think about ambient rhetoric this way.
Yeah, and we can take this idea into our classrooms. I mean, and this is the move to the composition classroom that we've all been waiting for.
not that we have to, but we are teachers, right? Let's go there.
And it's important. Just this idea of care. You know, I think that one of the things that I try to help my students understand before they can make an argument, before they can really get into some of the nitty gritty of producing well-composed essays, they've got to care about what they're writing about. And so
totally.
We can figure out ways of encouraging students or cultivating students around places, things, issues, whatever it might be, that they can generally start to care about, to put down roots in, to attune themselves with. I think that kind of work de-emphasizes the traditional product-oriented or even process-oriented approach that we take in our writing classrooms, and puts it instead upon this idea of attunement and care.
And let me tell an example that makes me think of. I remember a student once who wanted to write an argument paper trying to convince other students to ride their bikes to campus, as a ecological. Isn't funny the word ecological coming up here, but you know what I mean. Save gas, blah blah blah. And as we were talking about it, I felt like none of the students' arguments were very convincing. And I kept saying, "Who do you think is really going to change their practices based on what you've said?" And finally, I asked her, "Well, do you ride your bike to campus?" And she said, "Well, no. It rains a lot. We're in Florida, of course." And had all these basic reasons that she hadn't even convinced herself. And when I thought of that, this way that I think using your phrase there, that the way that she wasn't attuned to what she cared about, but she also wasn't attuned to the larger situation going on here. Really, that reminds me of where Rickert ends up in chapter 8. He tells this great story of these folks on Toronto Island who were resisting the plans to build a bridge so that cars could come onto this island that currently didn't have cars on it. And I feel like Rickert does this, for me, pretty amazing job of helping me see ambient rhetoric in action in a way that I wish I could have told my student then. Because here's what he said. He said that the Toronto Islanders, in a way that they somewhat did, but somewhat could have done better, they, quote, need to move from the idea of countering to what we might describe as enlivening, making their unique way of life real, palpable, and valuable to others and to themselves. Page 259. In other words, those folks living on Toronto Island, they didn't need classical argument. They didn't need to stand up in a courtroom and be like, okay, if I invent this well enough and arrange it well enough and use the right style and memorize and deliver it, then people will be convinced. Right. That just wasn't enough. They needed to let people know what the entire island was like, in what ways the island disclosed itself to them, in ways that affected what their lives were like, and how they lived there, and all of the complexities of what that means to live somewhere. And so if only I could have told my student that, hey, what are all of the complex ways that cars and bikes are wrapped up in the way that you live, the way that you enact your life as a student? Could you in some way invite people into that kind of living? In an ambient sense, with attention to everything that you can find and everything that does disclose itself to you, always knowing that you can't know everything, that there will always be some things that are withdrawing.
All right. Well, we've had a conversation.
Yeah.
It's been a good one. We've tried our best to emphasize the pieces that have caused us to do the most thinking. But what's most useful here is that this is a book that is going to be a wonderful tool for rhetoricians in the future. And maybe we could end by going back to Ricardian.
Recursion.
I think so too. A recursion definition of rhetoric.
Yeah, well, he defines it a couple times.
He does.
And uses pretty similar language whenever it comes up. I've got one here at the bottom of 186.
Okay.
See how that goes. He says that he's claimed that rhetoric is a responsive way to reveal the world for others. That sounds kind of positive and friendly, right? We're doing this together. It involves...
Great. Yeah. Makes me care.
Yeah. And what are the means it involves? Well, it involves affective, symbolic, and material means. This is not just symbolic. This is very purposely beyond the symbolic.
Exactly.
And it involves those means in our attempts to reattune or transform how others inhabit the world in a way that leads them to act or not. That sounds like it's kind of on the borderline of persuasion, but it's more than persuasion, right?
I think Rickert would like that, actually, that rhetoric is more on the borderlines of persuasion than persuasion itself. He goes on that next page, 187, to talk about the ways that rhetoric is responsive in a number of ways keyed to language itself.
Hmm.
And again, not just everyday symbolicity, but the rich choreography of background relations that emerge with a culture and give place to the terms we use.
And you emphasize place there, I think, in a really, really important way.
Yeah. He goes on, both symbolicity and the choreographic background emerge through reciprocal relations with other beings, people, culture, and material things. And we're back to Wrigley Field.
Of course.
Yeah.
People, culture, and material things. I mean, like we said, we can't get away from them.
Thinking now, again, back through these ideas that Rickert introduces, the reason that we came to this example was because it didn't have a clear, you know, very easily drawn out meaning behind
it.
But certainly we were changed. Certainly we were moved. Certainly we were affected in ways that were profound and very memorious. I'll never forget that experience. And this maybe goes back to this idea of what a sonic rhetoric leads us towards.
Yeah.
Are these moments of dissonance and harmony. And this, I guess I like, maybe you can help me riff on this a little bit because I'm riffing here at the end.
No, I like it.
But again, just this idea that the sonic, well, that rhetoric in general operates at this much greater level than the discursive and the symbolic, but that it is indeed embedded within the places that we inhabit, the people that we interact with, the things in our pockets. You know, I have several pictures that night from my phone that I took.
And I think the combination of all of that is part of why we love this study, why we love this field. I mean, both of us are going to be students of music and players of music no matter what area we're in. But I think it's important that we decided to work in rhetoric and to insist that other parts of ourselves, that embodied affect, got invited into it as well.
Exactly.
I think that's why sonic rhetorics are important. It is a reminder of how we can invite everything in more than just words into our lives.
Yeah, well, and just to go off that a little bit, I think that, you know, if you start to look at the ways that sound scholars are dealing with and in rhetoric, we have folks who do work in music, you know, and Kyle and I tend to be interested in music. I'm interested in archival work and history, but we also have people that are interested in social movements. We have people who are interested in sound and glitch. We have fantastic work coming out on sound and deafness.
Sound art.
And we also have wonderful work in soundscape and kind of embedded sonic environments. All of these, like sound itself is wide open for the kinds of study that are invited by Rickard an ambient approach.
I love that word invited by. We're essentially invited to do this kind of work through this book. It's almost a, hey, please take the next steps. And sound is a clear part of that.
And rather than closing off sonic studies as one kind of rhetorical work, it literally and radically opens it up.
I think that's a good place to end.
I do too.
We'd like to thank Composition Forum for inviting us to do this review. We'd like to thank University of Illinois for allowing us to use this studio to record this in.
Thanks also to Thomas Rickard.
Right.
Yeah, Shure Microphone also. Shure Microphones.
Can I say that John Stone exclusively uses Shure microphones and whatever cymbals.
Yeah, that's right.
Yes. And now I need to find a mastering engineer who can make this as loud as possible. We need to enter the loudness wars full throttle, ready to take on the world with the sound.
Yeah. All right, folks. Turn it up. We'll see you next time.
Rock and roll.